Good morning and welcome to KBOO's Membership Drive program on our environment and how we're co-evolving with it, climate change, positive solutions. That, of course, was We Just Want the World by Dave Rovics, and that particular track we heard was Parking Lots and Strip Malls. I'm Chris Andre. My guests this morning joining us here in live in the KBOO studios are Peter Schoonmaker of the Illihi Institute and Daniel Lurch of the Post Carbon Institute. We'll also be having Mark Rabinowitz of Oil Empire Renown, and Olivia Schmidt will be joining us by phone with some good news for a change. Climate change, of course, is a global reality. It's a threat to millions of lives, and it's actually where we are, even who we are. Indeed, it's really part of us. Right now, we can't afford the luxury of fear unless we put it to good use as a motivator. There's a lot to be done. Changes are coming on faster than most people predicted. NASA climate scientist Jim Hansen says that we have 10 years to turn things around. I'd say that's a little optimistic. So, what are the solutions? We are the solution. The human species is the source of the problems we face. We are the solution. It will take a huge sea change in the way that we see our world and the ways that we live in it as a community. Climate change is already redefining the way that we use the word community, and it's going to continue to do so for the foreseeable future. So, with that in mind, we've assembled visionary leaders from a number of disciplines to talk about solving the problem of climate change with the solution of community change. So, as I mentioned before, joining us this morning are Peter Schoonmaker of the Illihi Institute, Daniel Lurch of the Post Carbon Institute, Mark Rabinowitz of Oil Empire, and, of course, Olivia Schmidt will be here also with Olivia Schmidt will be joining us by phone, and here in Cascadia we face two major hurdles, of course, liquefied natural gas and unchecked growth, as personified by this proposed Columbia crossing bridge to sprawl. Two very bad ideas that were made really last century and in no way fit our current reality, and that's what we're here to talk about this morning. First off, though, we've got some good news. We're often accused of nothing but bad news. Well, this is good. Joining us is Olivia Schmidt of Riverkeeper. Good morning, Olivia. She'll be with us in just a moment. Here is actually a brief on this wonderful heads up. Citizens applaud. Here's the headline. LUBA, Land Use Board of Appeals, a decision denying Bradwood LNG terminal and pipeline. Hear that, listeners? Citizens applaud. LUBA decision denying Bradwood LNG terminal and pipeline. So, all those times that you braved the wind, the rain, and the cold to stand out there with the sign saying no LNG, it's beginning to pay off. We'll have Olivia in just a moment. Good morning, Olivia. Are you there yet?
Yes, good morning.
Thank you. You probably were there all along.
Yeah. we have some great news today about in the LNG struggle. Yesterday, the Land Use Board of Appeals remanded the Bradwood Landing decision on two important points. About 7 months ago, the Clatsop County Commission signed off on a number of land use changes that were required to essentially prove that the Bradwood Landing permit was compatible with all of their land use laws. We appealed, Columbia Riverkeeper and other organizations appealed many of those changes. And the two on which we won were really key points. The Clatsop County Commission changed the definition of protect in Bradwood's protection of endangered fish in the Columbia River. So where normally in the law it says a facility has to protect endangered species, Clatsop County changed that to attempt to protect. So the Land Use Board of Appeals saw that that was an egregious error. So that's being sent back to the Clatsop County Commission. In addition to that, we challenged the idea that the Bradwood Landing Terminal, which would be two 17-story high regasification terminals with giant tankers and other facilities that would be needed to run those the regasification, the Clatsop County Commission said that that terminal would be a small to medium facility, which is the only size of facility that's permitted in that particular zone. obviously that industrial development is massive size. It's not an appropriate fit for that part of the estuary on the Columbia River, and so that is another piece of that decision that will be sent back to Clatsop County. This essentially puts Bradwood back at square one in terms of gathering permits. They now no longer have a land use compatibility statement that is valid, which was also invalidated by the pipeline referendum that we spoke about many times on your show. So we're celebrating a huge victory in the anti-LNG coalition today. Bradwood going back to the drawing board to prove that it has land use compatibility, which at this point it does not. And the Land Use Board of Appeals had validated the concerns of the anti-LNG coalition that has identified that Bradwood Landing will kill salmon and that it is a completely inappropriate development for a protected estuary in the lower Columbia River.
Olivia, thank you so much. This couldn't have been timed better. We are we're of course, delighted to have you join us this morning for this forum. You're listening, of course, to your community radio station, your audio environment, KBOO 90.7 Portland, Oregon. I'm Chris Andre. My guests this morning are Peter Schoonmaker of the Elihi Institute, and we also have Daniel Lurch of the Post Carbon Institute here with us to talk about some of the challenges and the solutions. Daniel, would you like to start off?
Sure. Well, Chris, you had asked me to come in to talk a bit about the transition movement, which you've started to get involved in. And I think a lot of folks in Portland are starting to learn more about the transition. This is a movement that started in Ireland and then the UK by a fellow named Rob Hopkins. And the essential idea is organizing at the grassroots level, taking action at the grassroots level to transition our communities through, I guess, what my colleague Richard Heimer calls the hump of industrial civilization, transitioning towards on the downward side. So, you know, finding these local solutions for peak oil, for climate change, for peak food, peak water, all the different challenges that we're facing. What's interesting about the transition movement, I think partly why it has really taken off like wildfire. I mean, there are transition groups and groups that are looking at doing transition all throughout the world. I mean, well into the thousands at this point. I think what transition figured out and what Rob Hopkins and his colleagues figured out was this basic idea that if we can just get people at the most local level to build interpersonal relationships, get them educated about what's happening, then give them tools for actually taking some kind of meaningful action at the local level. So not just talking about it, not just grabbing about it, not just protesting about it, and doing something more than just writing in letters to, say, local officials, but actually, you know, organize community gardens, organize local, you know, health clinics, that sort of thing. That's the kind of action that is needed on a widespread basis throughout the world. Having all these little experiments happening also in all these different places, because the problems and the solutions for every locality are going to be unique to those places. So only those local people can understand recognize the problems and find the right local solution. So it's still this big experiment in many ways, and folks can check it out. It's transitiontowns.org. And just recently, there's been a group here in the United States that has organized with help from Transition Network in the UK and also Post Carbon Institute here in the States, my employer. And that effort is called Transition United States. And you'd have to Google it. I don't know the website offhand because they're just getting started. Portland Peak Oil here in Portland, some of the folks there are involved in that group. And it's a really great time for people to look into that and start getting involved.
So specifically here with these two issues that Cascadia is faced with, and you know, I like the term Cascadia because it more aptly describes a region. We're not really Oregon and Washington, mm-hmm. with a river, you know, in the middle. We really are all, if whatever happens around the Columbia River, Bradwood Landing, Columbia Crossing is going to affect all of us, and transitioning is, I think, of vital importance to people in Washington, listeners out there in Washington, you know, also are pretty concerned about what this is going to mean for them. Can you talk about how transitioning, the concept of transitioning, and Columbia Crossing and LNG, I would imagine that transitioning would look at those problems and say, well, one solution to sprawl and too much traffic and so forth is not to build yet another bridge and make it possible to sprawl even more, but to localized sources of food, jobs, and that sort of thing. Can you
talk absolutely. A little bit about that? The transition movement is very connected to this concept of relocalization that my group, Post Carbon Institute, was really instrumental in developing over the last few years. We used to be the home of what was known as the Relocalization Network, which was its own international network of grassroots organizations, mostly working on peak oil, but with an eye towards relocalization, meaning finding ways of meeting our most basic needs as locally as possible and reducing our dependence on these massive global supply chains. So from that perspective, and transition is very much in line with that as well, you would look at things like Bradwood Landing, you would look at things like the Columbia River Crossing and recognize those projects as pieces of infrastructure that serve that globalized economy, an economy that really does not make any sense in the post-oil era, really in the post-carbon era. And again, I think that's partly why the transition movement and the relocalization concept is so attractive to so many people, because it's saying we can oppose these things from a standpoint that goes far beyond the simple, almost NIMBY, not in my backyard concept of, well, I don't want more traffic in my neighborhood, or I don't want a big LNG gasification plant in my neighborhood. It puts in this much broader context of this makes no sense from an environmental perspective, from an economic perspective, from a local community and economic resilience perspective, and then we can act on it in that way. And I think that's a really important development, I think, in how grassroots activism can address these problems.
Yeah, we are the problem, we are the solution, and that's really good news. We want to really, with all of these efforts, these grassroots efforts, I believe, are based on transcending or transitioning out of a fear. Climate change is daunting. A lot of people look around at the world, at the polar, all this. People are decimating habitat for endangered species at breakneck speed. Everyone knows that, and it's easy to be paralyzed by fear. Peter Schoonmaker of the Illihi Institute. The word Illihi is an inspired choice. Absolutely inspired. Could you give listeners the definition of Illihi? Because more and more, it exactly describes the position that grassroots efforts are now starting to coalesce around.
Sure. Well, we chose the name from the local language, the indigenous language to here in our region, the Chinook jargon. And Illihi is the Chinook word for land, country, place, earth. It's what you see when you look out the window. And it's also kind of a cognate of Tillicum, which is people. So Illihi, Tillicum, land, people are very closely connected in the Chinook language. So that's where it comes from.
So the people, autochthonous people, original people here, language is really the way we see the world. Language is how we think. We dream in our language. So original people here would see themselves as an integral part of the land. And as invasive species human beings came in, they've changed that in a lot of ways. Peter, let's talk about the Illihi Institute and what the Institute actually means, what it's been doing. It certainly is a conduit for information, and actually held first lecture series was on peak oil. This year's, of course, is on desire. And talk a little bit about that.
Sure, yeah. And what does desire have to do with oil?
Plenty.
Plenty, I think, but some people don't get the connection. And actually, Daniel and I worked together on a kind of a oil, water, and Oregon symposium back in 2006, and I learned a lot from that. And after that, we kind of asked this question: well, we know we've got this problem. We know we're entering a post-carbon economy. It's pretty clear. Why can't we get our act together? In fact, some people have known this for 10, 20, 30 years, but it's on our minds now. It's clearly, if you don't know we're entering into a post-carbon economy, you're not paying attention. Then the question is, what do you do? So why haven't we gotten our act together? And we came up with four reasons. Our current economy is really hard to buck. Our belief systems are hard to shake off. Kind of human nature and our desire to consume things is, we're still screaming and fighting this being torn away from our lattes and our iPhones. We don't want that to end. We have those deep desires. And then kind of the political game, power and politics. So we designed a series of four lecture years around those topics. And this year, we did money, we did belief systems, and this year we're doing desire. And a lot of people are asking, well, desire, and we're doing like kind of the nature of desire, but also the, you know, why we're attracted to each other, addiction, Wall Street and desire, happiness. And I think a lot of people ask, what's that have to do with the environment and the world and et cetera? And the answer is really simple. Desire drives consumption, and we're consuming the earth.
And it's we've confused what we need with what we want, too, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're trying to get at this kind of this get down to that level of clarity and simplicity. And so, producing these this lecture series this year, which the first one starts on Friday with the philosophy talk guys. And you can go to our website, www.illahee.org, and find out more about it. But we're, you know, basically, you know, trying to get at this nature of desire, and not so that we can control our desires, but really so that we're not controlled by them. And so it's, you know, we could have had six lectures on voluntary simplicity and organic gardening and all that, but which is great. That's where you get to once you kind of understand desire. But it's like, how can you be happy with a reduced set of desires? In fact, how does a reduced kind of desire in control produce more happiness? Because even with all our consumption, we're not the happiest country in the world. There's other countries that have less kind of per capita consumption, Denmark and a lot of the Scandinavian countries, but even countries that are significantly poorer than us. And they're kind of, you know, normative happiness as measured by psychologists is higher than ours. So we're consuming. We're not even all that happy about all this consumption.
And we've been sold a false bill of goods, really. The general public believes that we absolutely have to have LNG for energy, for what? So we can power more ships to go back and get more LNG, so that then we can pollute the environment more, generate more problems, and then technology will have to come up with solutions, so we could all invest in that. And I think we've deluded ourselves on both counts. I think that, this is my opinion, both the Bradwood Landing and any other LNG terminal in Oregon and the Columbia Crossing are mass hallucinations, that we've deluded ourselves into thinking that this is what we really need. We need more sprawl. We need more energy, fossil fuel imported from totalitarian regimes, both of which, of course, obsolete.
I prefer totalitarian oil. It's kind of like a Stumptown thing. You know, you can get like coffee from Ethiopia or Sumatra, but man, there's just nothing better than Iranian oil.
I mean, it's stronger.
It's so much better than Canadian oil. Yeah, Canadian oil is so weak and polite.
I just want to do a quick plug for Peter's Illahee lectures. I go to them every year. I get a season pass every year. They're absolutely worth the cost. You can even get the cheaper student prices if you have to. But absolutely top-notch lectures, always very, very engaging, and probably one of the most feisty lecture audiences I've ever come across.
Absolutely. You can throw stuff. You can wad up your program and throw it at the speaker.
Happens all the time.
It's a lot of fun. And so I'll do a cross-plug for Post Carbon Institute, just that these guys have been, they're way out in front of everybody else on this stuff. And some of the solutions that, like the standard, Tom Friedman someday will discover the Post Carbon Institute,
yeah,
you know.
We hope.
We hope he discovers something. But, you know, in 4 or 5 years, he'll arrive there.
These groups are all part of the really important initial step, and that is, of course, really observing, really looking at the situation and asking ourselves, not do we need another bridge in the Columbia Crossing of the Columbia River, do we need LNG, but what purpose does it really serve? We don't really know. We just assume that this is something that we've got to have. We have been sold a false bill of goods. And the long-term consequences, which, again, just because it's new doesn't mean it's a good thing. History is as abundantly full of examples of great new ideas that if anyone had taken the time to observe the situation, observe all the elements, take into account people in a landscape, we would never have made these decisions in the first place. Right now we have an opportunity to move ahead into a new century where we're not dependent on far-flung regimes, we're not dependent on extraction of resources and continued expansion, but we return to where we've actually always been, and that, of course, is the ground that we stand on. It's really important. These two organizations are very important. We should be joined a little later in the program by Mark Rabinowitz of Oil Empire. Right now, I need to let you know, though, that you're listening to your community radio station. Again, this is where a lot of solutions can start. And that's why we're doing a membership drive right now. Part of solving some of these problems is to keep the conversation going and make it possible for people to observe clearly and accurately what we're faced with and approach it without fear. We're going to be going in just a couple of minutes to membership drive. Let's talk a little bit more about these two. How are these two related, either one of you? How do you see Columbia Crossing and this LNG fiasco? How are they interrelated?
Well, I think what you were saying a bit earlier, we've been sold a false bill of goods. And there's different ways that you can cut that. Obviously, part of why we're looking at importing LNG from places like Qatar and some less friendly nations, more totalitarian. I'm sure there's some scale of totalitarianism and general nastiness that we can apply there. We're importing this fuel. We're going to such lengths to bring this kind of fuel in because we do need it. We need it because of the infrastructure that we've built. We've built an infrastructure that requires a lot of our homes to be heated by natural gas. We've built our economy to, in many ways, be incredibly dependent on natural gas for electricity, for industrial heat, what have you. Were those good decisions to make that to build up that kind of dependency? Absolutely not. But that's the reality that we face. So, and these are the hard decisions. By the bridled landing not coming in, it may well result that we have more electricity blackouts in California, and that's part of the decision-making process. And I think this is, to bring this kind of back around, this is, I think, where things like transition and this more local focus on things is really important and comes in. The transition and the relocalization frame forces us to ask, okay, well, we need to heat our homes, we need to have electricity. What are different ways that we can do that? What are the local sources of energy that we can develop, not just in Clatsop County, but all throughout Cascadia, so that we don't need the Bradwood Landing? And the great thing is there are many examples these days all across the world about doing local energy, about having local efficiencies. It's much different than even 10 years ago. There are many examples in Scandinavia, especially, where very modern equipment and modern plant is used to, for example, in Sweden, to take the leftover waste products of the forestry industry, turn it into wood pellets, use that to fire combined heating and power plants that provide both electricity and hot water and even industrial heating to an entire city, using local energy and what is essentially carbon neutral energy. But some decisions had to be made. There had to be a decision at some point in that region to move away from the old fossil fuel sources and develop something locally. So it really is all, I think that's the big and fortunate lesson here, that this is ultimately about decisions. This is ultimately about policies that we can choose to change.
We do have Mark Rabinowitz on the line right now. Need to let you know you're listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon. Good morning, Mark. Thank you so much.
Yes, hello.
Well, we're talking about LNG, Columbia Crossing, and how we can possibly get to the future with bad ideas like that at our backs.
Well, the Columbia River Crossing is part of a bigger paradigm that assumes endless growth on a finite planet. Our transportation system, our energy system, our monetary system assumes that we're going to keep growing and growing and growing, but the Earth is round and is not getting any bigger. And part of the challenge for dealing with the peak of fossil fuels of all sorts is to shift the way society works away from the growth model to a steady state. In an old growth forest, growth and decay are in balance. There is no such thing as waste in a forest, even though we have the timber industry trying to persuade us of that. And with the Columbia River crossing in particular, this is designed for the year 2030, assuming that there's going to be this huge increase in traffic across the interstate. And traffic levels have peaked and have started to decline in Oregon. When the price of oil started to go up, people started driving less. Who would have thunk it? And the Columbia River crossing is just a giant bailout for the trucking industry, for real estate developers, and the road lobby. And it's only a small fraction of a much larger proposal to widen I-5 from Canada all the way down to Mexico and to build hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars of new freeways all over the country, including $18 billion here in Oregon.
Well, eventually it'll make a nice rock garden when all the weeds come up through the cracks. Mark Rabinowitz, it's absolutely been a pleasure to have you on. Even I'm sorry for such a brief while. That, of course, my guest is Mark Rabinowitz of Oil Empire joining us by phone. We would like very much to have you back again in the very near future to discuss at greater length.
Can I give a website?
Yes, please do.
On the Columbia River crossing, there is a large amount of detail on some of the illegalities of the project at road-scholar.org, or you can go to naftahighway.org, and there's a lot of material there that will be of interest to KBOO listeners.